Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mealer here. Great to have you with us today. You know, we announced earlier that Liz Freemuth would be with us today to talk about Christmas gifts, but she is under the weather, so Diana Alfuth has leaped into the breach. She is retired UW Extension horticulture educator. She's been with us so many times, always a lot of fun. She's retired from Pierce County, and great to have her back. And we're going to start by talking about how to keep your garden soil happy. And, of course, we'll be taking all of your other gardening questions, plant questions, as we move along today. And I hope you will join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. It's 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. And if you had some triumphs in your garden this year, or maybe some disasters, or maybe some funny things that happened in the garden, I hope you'll send those along. You can email them in to talk@WPR.org or just give us a call at 800-642-1234, and we'll take those as well. But, of course, your legitimate garden questions are on the board right now. Diana, welcome back. Good to have you with us.
Thanks, Larry. It's great to be here.
So, we were talking about soil to start with, and healthy soil, and giving your soil a good balanced diet, you might say. What happens in our gardens when we give the soil too much of a good thing?
Well, that's a big topic. We could be here days talking about, but really, you know, at this time of year, a lot of times people are, you know, it's hard to stop gardening if you're a passionate gardener and you're stuck inside. And so people do think about their soil, and a lot of people will save stuff up over the winter in order to put it into their soil in spring. And that's a great idea to think about. Unfortunately, sometimes there's a lot of messaging out there about certain things like eggshells and coffee grounds and this or that. And I just want to remind everyone that there is no one silver bullet that's going to double your production and solve all your problems and that sort of thing. And soil is it's science. It's a living ecosystem down in there. And just like with us, soil, plants need nutrients, just like us. But if we eat all of one thing and or too much of something, everything kind of gets goofed up. So the best thing that you can do, you know, in my area anyway, the soil is frozen. So it's kind of late for a soil test. Mm-hmm. But in the South, if you can get into your soil, you could still do a soil test. And it's always a good idea to start there. And I want everyone to remember, we live in Wisconsin. And Wisconsin is an agricultural state for a reason. And that's because we have super highly fertile soils pretty much everywhere throughout the state. You know, we are not New Mexico where soils are fertile. And so if you look out your window and you see a patch of trees growing or, you know, a woodland or whatever, that means the soil is fertile enough for plants to grow. So there are 17 essential plant nutrients that all plants need, and they need only those 17 nutrients. Three of them they get from the air, and that's carbon and oxygen and hydrogen, and the rest have to come through the soil. If there was a soil where there was zero of one of those nutrients, nothing would grow. Okay. Oh. But if there's even a little bit of it, it will grow. And every plant takes up each of those 17 essential nutrients. So when you throw those plants on your compost pile and they decompose, all of those 17 nutrients are released. And that's why compost is so good. And compost is balanced because it will have all of those nutrients in it to feed your next crop of plants. So often I hear of people saving their eggshells all winter long and then drying them in the oven and grinding them up and putting them in the holes with their tomatoes to prevent blossom end rot, because blossom end rot is caused by a lack of calcium, and eggshells have calcium. And I don't recommend that you do that for a couple of reasons. In the first place, it's not that tomatoes need more calcium than other plants. They just have some challenges with transporting it up through the plant to those developing fruits, and that's when you get blossom end rot. So it is more a matter of weather and water.
Water.
Yeah, because the calcium comes up through the roots and moves through the plant to those developing tomatoes with water. So if there's not enough water, or if the plant is not actively growing because it's too cold out, then it's not pulling that water up. That's when you get the problems with that. But if you're adding Tums or eggshells or Epsom salts, which is magnesium and sulfur, or any one thing that has a lot of a particular nutrient in it, you can goof up the soil balance and the plant's ability to take up nutrients. So calcium is antagonistic in high amounts with other nutrients like boron and magnesium. So if you put too much calcium in your soil, you could end up with a magnesium deficiency. Even though there's enough magnesium in the soil, the plants can't take it up because the calcium's in the way. And it's the same with adding Epsom salt. We hear that that's a good fertilizer. But not in Wisconsin. Because we really don't have, it would be very rare in Wisconsin to find any soil that's deficient in calcium or magnesium or any of the trace nutrients. And that's why that when you buy a bag of fertilizer, it's only the three biggies in there, nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium, because those are the ones that might become deficient. But the other stuff, we have enough of, unless, now if you had a really sandy soil and your pH was below like 5.7, you might be lower on calcium. But if your pH is above the high fives, you have enough calcium. So adding more could goof things up. So the bottom line is, over the winter here, save all your kitchen scraps, anything you pick off your house plants and whatever, and throw it in or on a compost pile. You don't have to have a fancy composter or compost bucket under the kitchen or however you want to do it. You can just throw it outside. It can freeze. And in spring, you can throw it on your compost pile and work it all in. And then on your garden, like your vegetable garden, the recommendation is to add 2 inches of compost every year, because the organic matter in there does break down. And if you do that, you will have all of the calcium, magnesium, and every trace nutrient that your plants are going to need. So, you know, I really caution people about overdoing something. And, you know, the thing is that I'm not saying that, like, using Epsom salts or calcium or whatever isn't recommended somewhere, maybe in, I don't know, Arkansas or something like that, where soils, there are places, you know, in the country where soils might be deficient on something. And so these recommendations might be useful somewhere, but not likely in Wisconsin. And if you want to be absolutely sure, get an extensive soil test done. You can test for all of those trace nutrients and see if you're in the normal range. And then you know. And then you know where to put your efforts versus...
Yeah. versus eggshell. Although you could throw eggshells. And coffee grounds is the other one that comes up a lot.
Right. And yes, you can throw those things on your compost pile. Absolutely. And you should, because they do add stuff. And, you know, coffee grounds were basically once a plant. So anything that was once a plant... and if you want to throw your eggshells on there too, that's fine. All of that will add certain nutrients. The other one is wood ash. So over winter, people are having fireplaces, you know, fires in their fireplace or whatever, and throwing a little bit of wood ash on your garden or your compost pile is okay. There are nutrients in there and stuff, but remember that it's super, super high pH, and so it can knock your pH out of whack. And again, it's just like with our own diets, anything in moderation, a little of this, a little of that, it all, you know, works out. But I don't recommend, you know, picking up sacks of used coffee grounds from the coffee shop and using those, because coffee grounds are kind of balanced, but there's nothing magical about coffee grounds. So if you have them, throw them on your compost. But don't go out of your way and put a lot of effort into any one thing, because plants like a balanced diet too. And we are blessed in Wisconsin to have these fertile soils. And I always say, you know, if you have a healthy crop of weeds growing in your garden, your soil's plenty fertile and it has all of the nutrients in there, because the weeds need the same nutrients that your tomatoes and peppers and squash do. And so if the weeds are growing, so are your crops.
Diana Alfuth, our guest today, excuse me, recently retired as UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County. Questions for her, comment, and experience to share. I hope you'll join in. The number to call is 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, the email address, talk@wpr.org. That's talk@wpr.org. Let's talk about the compost itself and the compost, you know. You say, well, how much should you be? How do you know when what to add and how much?
For adding compost to the soil. So again, you know, we usually say like 2 inches of compost a year. Just put on the top, kind of work it into the soil a little bit, and you're good to go. After a year, basically what we're adding is organic matter that's going to enhance the structure of the soil so that the roots can push through easily and the nutrients are there. So soils that are finer textured like clay, or that have a lot of organic matter in it, they tend to hold on to nutrients better than a sandy soil. So if you have a clay soil, you have more nutrients in there than, but it can be where, like, if the clay dries out, the roots can't push through that heavy soil very well. So adding organic matter in the form of compost loosens that up. If you have sandy soil, sand particles don't hold on to nutrients as much. So adding organic matter via compost in there helps to add nutrient holding capacity as well as moisture holding capacity. But organic matter decomposes because microbes in the soil eat it and break it down. UV rays, if it's on the surface and the sun is hitting it, breaks it down. So after a year, only 10% of that organic matter is still there. And that's why you have to keep adding it. It's not a one-time thing. You really do need to add fresh organic matter every year. Now, you can overdo it. If you add too much compost, you can get it to be like really mucky. It can hold too much soil. You can get it, you know, where if it's wet, it's kind of stinky and stuff. And then the ammonium levels in it can also get too high. And if there's too much ammonium, that will affect other nutrient uptake. So you don't want to overdo it. But adding 2 inches a year is a good thing. Now, for flower beds, like a perennial bed or shrub beds and stuff, if you're putting an organic mulch on the top, like shredded wood, for example, as that decomposes down at the bottom, that organic matter kind of gets into the soil a little bit. So worms take some down and that sort of a thing. So you can't obviously till it into a perennial bed, but by mulching around your perennials, you're still getting a little bit of organic matter added to that soil profile for the plants to grow. And in the vegetable garden, you can do a no-till thing where you have the organic matter on the top and then you just plant into that, or you can work that compost into the top few inches of the soil every year before you plant.
Diana Elfeth, our guest, and she'll be with us for another hour at least. We'll be talking with her and answering your questions. And I know we've got Dan and Mosini and I think Ginny and Platteville coming up. But just a reminder, you can join in too at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk. Coming up in the last half hour of the show, we'll take a look at how to select and care for your Christmas tree. Right now, we're talking about taking general gardening questions from our expert, Diana Elfeth. It's great to have her back. And again, you can join us 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Dan in Mosini, thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Thank you so much, Larry and Diana. I just love listening to this show. I live on what was a hobby farm, and the first question is, we always, I don't want to say grew organic, but we just used cow manure and that for fertilizer, and I've taken the place over years back, and I kind of do the same thing with gardens. You don't, and someday I might think about growing some stuff as far as in trying to get certified for organic. If you haven't used any commercial fertilizers like urea or anything, is it easier to get it certified for organic, or do organic farms use anything like that or not?
So I'm not totally up to date on all the latest organic standards, but generally speaking, urea is made through petroleum, I believe, and therefore it's not organic. It always used to be anyway that you couldn't have put any kind of chemical or petroleum-based stuff on there for 3 years in order to get certified. And there are specific rules depending on which certifying agency you end up going with and getting certified under. But urea is not considered organic, I believe, because it's petroleum based. And so you do go for nitrogen sources. You have to go through things like compost, fish emulsion, blood meal, things like that, that are certified organic products in order to get your higher nitrogen concentration comparable to urea.
Yeah. Dan, you had another question, I think.
Yeah, I think it goes back to what Diana was talking about getting your soil out of balance. And I did that because I burned wood and I was putting ashes on the garden, wood ash. And I had the soil tested through the UW. And I apologize, I can't remember the compost, the what I had to put on it to try and get the soil balanced again. They told me about it. I went to the fertilizer plant and they gave me the stuff I needed.
Oh, yeah. That's great. And that is a danger because, again, you know, wood ash does have nutrients in it, but a little of this, a little of that. And wood ash is is a super high pH. So it probably raised your pH way too high. And the thing, again, with pH is if it's too high or too low, plants can't take up nutrients, even though those nutrients are in the soil. So iron is a great example. If the pH is up in the mid sevens and higher, a lot of plants don't take up iron, and so they get iron deficiency symptoms. But if you test the soil, there's plenty of iron in the soil, but the plants can't take it up if the pH is too high or too low. And most plants like a pH in the high sixes, low sevens, you know, on that slightly acidic edge there. And so you probably got your soil pH super high from the ash, and then you probably added sulfur to bring that pH back down because that's the normal thing.
Dan, is that what you did? Well, you don't remember, or do you remember sulfur?
I'd have to go up and look on the computer because that's where the results are. One last question, I'll let you go. I use horse manure. I have access to that. And then also what I do is I cut some of the old hayfield that's just wild, and I use that to mulch a lot. Is there anything wrong with putting the hay over it and just letting it for the season? Then I till it in. I've got a big rototiller behind a tractor. Then at the end of the season, I'll till it in, leave it break down over the winter, and then go from there. Is there any negatives to using that for the mulch?
Not really. So I also have access to horse manure, happily. But it is better if that horse manure sits for a while and decomposes rather than putting it on fresh. As for the hay, I mean, I do that too. I mulch with it. You know, this is how you stop having tomato blight, right? Is to prevent splashing. So I usually put down a layer of cardboard or newspaper and then some leafy hay on top for mulch, and that all gets worked in. The only possible concern is when you have fresh organic matter, so fresh manure or fresh, you know, like grass clippings or things like that, that are not composted first, the microbes can really go to town on that, and they can use up nitrogen. And so then it's possible that your plants are a little nitrogen starved. So because that hay that you're working into the soil isn't fully decomposed or composted first, you might need to add extra nitrogen fertilizer to balance that. But other than that, the only potential downfall would be if you were working a lot of that in year after year and it was getting to the point, like I mentioned earlier, that you can overdo compost and overdo organic matter. You just would want to make sure, you know, that it's not getting too high a percentage of organic matter in there. But I've never had that problem. I do pretty much what you're doing, and it works for me.
All right. There you go, Dan. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Deborah in Racine will give you a chance. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. So I have a question. We had a new raw wood maple floor installed in our kitchen, and they did a shape, you know, they sanded it down, and they collected all the shavings, and I had them put it in a black garbage bag. And so I had the idea of either using it in my compost or actually applying it as mulch to like my perennial flower beds. Is that recommended or no?
Well, it could be useful if it is just wood. And, you know, even, you know, when they make wood floors and stuff, I don't know for sure if they treat that wood with any kind of chemicals or anything. You know, I don't know. So let's assume they don't and that it is just wood. And so then it's kind of like sawdust. And sawdust has nutrients in it, but it's a very high carbon versus nitrogen product. So we don't have time to get into all of the details of composting, but basically when you compost, you need to balance the carbon and nitrogen ratio in the pile in order for it to compost quickly and well. So you can sprinkle that in your compost. Don't throw it all in one clump. Spread it around with like kitchen scraps and anything that's fresher and juicier and greener. Like, you know, ideally you'd have like some grass clippings and stuff this time of year, not. And if you keep turning it and stuff with enough green or fresh matter, it will compost in there and be a great addition. You could also use it as a mulch around your perennials and stuff. And so it's just going to be similar to using, you know, a shredded wood product, except that it will compact and it might form a layer that water doesn't go through well.
Yeah. So
in order to get it thick enough to do what we want for mulch to keep weeds from growing through it, you're going to have a couple inches of packed sawdust.
Yeah, that's a pretty good point.
The water will run off of that. So, you know, if you just wanted to get rid of it and you sprinkled it, you know, at a light layer in between all your perennials and stuff, it'll decompose. It'll add, you know, recycle some nutrients there and stuff. But as far as using it as a true mulch for weed control, it's maybe not so good.
Yeah, I certainly agree with you on that one, Diana. Deborah, thank you so much. Appreciate the call. Let's go to Bob in Stoughton. Bob, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. Your expert here mentioned Boraxo and possibly using too much of it. And I had an experience with that that I'd like to share.
Okay.
I put it around the foundation of my house. I'm not sure that I actually remember why I did it, but I think it was to repel airwigs. But what happened is it killed the grass right next to the foundation. And my wife wasn't too happy with that, and so I discontinued that. But then I had to go back to trimming around the foundation, and I thought, you know what? This stuff was actually pretty nice because it's not really a herbicide, but it did a nice job of controlling the grass growing next to the foundation. And I'd only have to trim after mowing maybe twice a summer at the most, if at all.
What'd your wife think of that idea?
Well, to be honest, in the meantime, she had cancer and she's deceased. So I'm on my own now, and I went back to using it.
Well, you're never going to get grass to grow in there if you're putting borax in there on a regular basis, Diana.
Borax. Okay, I'm sorry. I didn't hear at first what it was, but borax. Yeah. So boron is one of the 17 essential plant nutrients. So all plants need boron. But boron is one of them that if it's in high amounts, it becomes toxic to plants. And so basically when you put it on really heavy, it becomes toxic. It kills the grass. And so, you know, there's already some boron in the soil. It may not be the worst thing to put along your foundation so that you don't have to string trim, because I hate string trimming. And it works because it kills it's toxic to plants. So borax is one of the things that is often recommended for controlling creeping Charlie. You'll hear that a lot. And that's why, because creeping Charlie has a lower tolerance for boron. And so the idea is that you put on enough borax to the point where it's toxic to the creeping Charlie, but not toxic to everything else. And
I had a caller from Iowa call one time and say she did that, and she killed her whole lawn because she put too much on. It's a tricky business.
And that's the problem, because you don't know how much your particular soil already has. And what happens a lot of times is people put on, you know, like a certain amount, and the creeping Charlie doesn't die. So they reapply. And at that point, they overdo it. And it takes a couple of years before that boron's going to reduce down enough to where you can get grass growing again. So it's a naturally occurring soil nutrient, but use with caution.
There you go, Bob. Feel free along the edge of your house. If you want to do that, just go ahead. I think Diana is telling you. And I appreciate your call. You can join in too, by the way. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234 or email to talk at WPR.org. But if you phone in, we'll get you on pretty quickly. Let's see. Ginny in Platteville called to ask what kind of soil she should use in her greenhouse. Nothing seems to be growing for her.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, there's got to be something else going on there maybe. But
The thing is that it's not necessarily the soil that's making things not growing there, but it might be the environment and the care. So typically in a greenhouse, we use a potting mix. So you don't use garden soil that actually has the sand, silt, and clay in it, but usually a potting mix, which is all compost and composted wood chips and a packaged product. And that has good drainage. It holds nutrients well, that sort of a thing. So if things aren't growing well and it's lots of different species of plants, then we're looking at various things like maybe overwater or underwater, maybe not enough light or too much light, maybe too cool or not cool enough, maybe over-fertilizing, which is usually the problem more so than under-fertilizing. So we'd really kind of have to start looking at what the specific symptoms are that are causing the problem. The thing is that whether, you know, it's in a greenhouse or your house plants, that sort of a thing, overwatering, especially in winter, is a big concern. And so you have to make sure that the surface, half inch to an inch on the surface of your house plants or of your greenhouse plants, is dry before you water again. And if the soil is already moist and you're adding more water to it, you could be drowning those roots, getting root rot diseases, various things like that. So it's kind of hard to say what's going on, but typically in a greenhouse, you use basic potting mix that you would buy for house plants, or it comes in big professional size bags as well.
I have an email from someone from actually a listener in Richmond County called to ask what she can add to her specialized geraniums to get them to bloom. Will African violet fertilizer help? I'm expecting that person has some African violet fertilizer laying around and wondering if that'll work.
So maybe, probably. The thing is that just because it's labeled for African violet, for African violets, it's nutrients are nutrients. Okay. So they might be in a slightly different percentage than something labeled for roses or something labeled for, just green plants or whatever, but it still has all of the nutrients in there. So go ahead and use it. Don't over apply it. Usually packaged fertilizers, you want to apply it at like half the rate that they tell you to, it's perfectly fine.
Well, you know, phosphorus is the blooming element, isn't it? You want to have a little higher phosphorus level to promote blooming, or am I wrong?
Yep, phosphorus is definitely one that contributes, that blooms need a lot of, as long as the plants have all of the other nutrients as well. If it's low in phosphorus, you can have fewer than normal blooms, but all of the fertilizers will have an analysis on the package to tell you exactly how much is in there, but they're all going to have the basics, so you can use them on any kind of plants.
Kathy in Ocano emailed, she uses old tarps and pool covers in her vegetable garden and plants veggies in slits she made in them. She's now making the slits much wider over concern that the tarps could be affecting the microflora of the soil and, of course, the water infiltration. Should she be using tarps at all? She noticed she's had poorer crop of butternut squash this year than ever. The rest of the veggies were okay, though.
Maybe.
Yeah.
So, the thing is that if you have one year where it's like, oh, this year my butternut squash didn't do well and stuff, you know, we have weird weather every year and there's always something that doesn't do well. So I wouldn't, make soil assumptions or anything based on one year of a poor crop. But her point is very good. If you have the tarps and stuff that don't allow water to get through, you do need to have a big enough slit or opening around those plants so that rain and water can get in there. Now, if you're using some kind of a drip irrigation system where you're watering right at the base of that plant, you might be getting water into that root zone just fine. But there are other issues that might come up. So, for example, especially if the tarp is darker color, it could heat up a lot, and then that heat could be damaging some of the microbes and stuff that are down in the soil. So it's a good idea to remove those tarps as soon as your crop is done, and then you can, you know, give the soil a little bit of time to heal and recover and that sort of a thing. But, you know, tarps can be really useful for moisture retention and weed control during the growing season. So, yeah, a big enough hole is, you know, getting a bigger hole is a good idea. And then usually putting some kind of like a straw or leaf mulch on top of the tarps to prevent heating up is also a good idea.
Yeah, that's a very good idea. Pat emailed to ask if you could offer advice on starting a compost pile. This show is inspiring her to start one.
Woohoo! That's wonderful. That's wonderful. Everybody should have a compost pile. And a big part of that is if you compost in your backyard, even if it's on a small scale, it's way better for the environment than throwing your kitchen scraps into the trash. Because when they go into the trash and they end up in a landfill, they get buried under this big mound of trash and they rot away in anaerobic conditions. And that creates methane, which is one of our biggest greenhouse gas problems contributing to climate change. So composting in your backyard is better for everything, including climate change. So the thing is that during the winter, I just recommend, again, you save all of your, anything that was once a plant in a bucket, on a pile out your back door, in a, you know, old garbage can, whatever, and hold on to it till spring. When spring comes, have any kind of, especially outdoors, like in the fall, if you saved any leaves, if you have some piles of leaves around and stuff, you can start building your compost pile. The biggest take homes with composting is you need your pile to be at least like 3 feet by 3 feet by 3 feet, because you have to have enough mass there for it to heat up in the middle. And then when you build that pile, you want to do like three parts brown dry stuff to one part green wetter stuff. So green wetter stuff would be like fresh grass clippings or kitchen scraps, stuff like that. And if you just keep alternating those, throw those all in a 3 foot pile, in about 3 days, it will heat up to about 140 degrees. And that's because all the microbes in there are starting to eat all of that stuff and break it down. And then you turn it every few days, it'll heat back up and you're on your way. The thing to remember is don't make it too complicated. So it is science, but you know, compost happens, right? So any kind of organic matter thrown on a pile is eventually going to compost. It's just a matter of speed. So think about it in the woods. The leaves fall off the trees, they decompose, they compost, and the nutrients are recycled, and it happens without us. We're just impatient. We want to get it faster so we can use it in different places. So then you want to do the three parts brown to one part green, stir it occasionally, make sure that it's has got enough moisture so that it feels like a wet, wrung-out sponge. And you can actually get compost in 8 to 10 weeks. Sometimes you see these tumblers and stuff that say compost in 4 weeks. Not likely. But, you know, 8 to 10 weeks, you can be getting compost depending on how actively you work it. But it's not hard. just anything that was once a plant. And then you can also, like I say, throw on some eggshells if you want. Crunch them up as much as possible because it takes a long time for eggshells to break down. But throw it on a pile. It'll rot.
Diana Alfoth, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County, just retired. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on WPR News. Larry Mueller here for Garden Talk with Diana Alfoth. Just a note that Monday's show, we'll be talking with tech expert Beth D'Angelo. And then later, we'll have a look at ways to reduce waste during the holidays. And speaking of holidays, just a reminder, too, that Santa Claus comes to the Larry Mueller Show on Christmas Eve in person to answer and talk with the young people in the audience, the kids, about what they'd like for Christmas and a little bit about Christmas. So that's going to be a lot of fun. That's on Christmas Eve. Right now, we're taking all kinds of things relating to gardens. We've zeroed in a lot on composting and making piles. And we haven't gotten to mulching. Well, a little bit about mulching. And I do want to get into that a bit more as well, because we're getting to the time when we should be applying some mulch to at least like our evergreens and our shrubs. But Jim in Janesville has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jim.
Hi, thanks. Yeah, so I have a composting question as well. So we have a place out back. We just put together a few wooden skids and tie them together. But I'm wondering about like bones, chicken bones, and along with the organic scrap from the kitchen, can I include bones in that scrap or should I separate those? Or
Okay.
Anything that was once a plant should go on your compost pile. Anything that was once an animal should not. And part of it is if you start throwing bones or meat scraps or cheese or milk or stuff on there, that's a whole different set of microbes that have to be there to decompose that. It takes a lot longer, and you're most likely to attract raccoons and rats and skunks and other things in there to your pile. So stay away from that. It's likely that by the time you're using your compost, you'd be picking the bones out then, because they really take a long time to break down anyway. So in a home gardening compost pile, stick to stuff that was once a plant.
All right, Jim, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Nicole in Waterford, we'll go to you now. Hi, Nicole.
Hi there. I get a compost pile, a leaf compost from over in a town in Muskego. And I'm just wondering the difference between the leaf compost and compost that you would do from your garden and leaves and from your home.
There's really not much. If they call it leaf compost, then it was probably mostly just leaves that were in that compost. Whereas at home, you might have leaves and grass clippings and young weeds that you pulled and garden cleanup and whatever else. So there's really not much of a difference. The only thing, like if you wanted to get really technical, it'd be that if it's the majority leaves that were in that compost, it might be heavier or lighter in certain nutrients than a more balanced compost might be. And it might also have a different pH than a more balanced compost might have. But either way, it's going to be good stuff.
Yeah, it will be. Nicole, thank you so much for calling. Again, you can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Andy emailed that you talked about adding 2 inches of compost to the soil per year. Do you leave that on the surface or work it into the soil?
So different people have different approaches to this. You can do either. I tend to work it into the top, like 2 inches of the soil, because most of the vegetables that we grow or annual flowers are, the roots are going to be in that top 6 to 8 inches of the soil. And so that's where you want the soil to be its best. And so I tend to work it in. There are some people who do a no-till method where you don't work up the soil, because the idea is when you work up the soil even a little bit, you're bringing weed seeds to the surface. And so they will just put that compost on top and then do their planting right into that, whether you're planting your seeds, you're planting them basically into the compost then. If you're doing transplants, you're digging down into the soil a little bit below that compost. So either method works. Remember that UV rays from the sun will break down organic matter. So if it's just on the surface, you'll probably lose some of that compost faster than if it's worked into the soil and not in direct sunlight. But it's kind of a little bit of a personal preference, and depending on what kind of equipment and how big your garden is and various things like that, how much work you put into it.
I mentioned mulch earlier, and, you know, we always say, you know, don't put the mulch around your shrubs and that until after the ground freezes, and I guess the ground's frozen, so this is probably the time. Am I right on that?
Yeah, exactly. So winter mulch. So if you're mulching for weed control around your basic perennials and shrubs and stuff, you can put that on at any time of year. You put on 4 inches thick and, you know, it smothers out weed seeds. If you're mulching perennials that are maybe marginally hardy, or things like strawberries, things that have the crowns of the plant might heave up in the winter or be exposed to the cold and then be damaged, that's the winter mulch that we should be doing right now. And you're right, you want to wait until the ground is frozen about 2 inches into the soil, because if you put it on when the soil's still thawed, then it keeps it warmer down there and you have more chance of fungal activity and stuff happening down there. So once it's frozen, now you can put on your mulch. You can use, you know, straw or leaves or dried grass clippings or evergreen boughs. The idea is to protect those crowns, and the idea is to keep the ground frozen. So one of the things that damages things like strawberry plants or coral bells, things that have big crowns, is freezing and thawing throughout the winter. And we don't know what our winter is going to bring. I'm okay if we have a nice warm winter like last year, but you know, we tend to have like January thaws and whatever. And if every time the soil melts and then refreezes, that water freezes in the soil and it pushes up on those crowns and it can push them up out of the ground. And that's what kills the plants. So we put it on the ground now when it's frozen. And the idea is we're keeping it frozen till early April. And then we can take that off. The ground can thaw out and the plants will be ready to go.
Dave in Beloit, it's your turn. Hi, Dave.
Hi, Larry. Hey, I have a question. I have a problem, like my asparagus bed is probably 15 years old, but it's got weeds in it like crazy. I've heard people say you can throw salt on it, but I'm afraid to do that because I don't want to kill the asparagus. But I'm wondering, can you mulch that asparagus, and will it come up through that mulch, or is that a bad idea?
That is a very common problem.
Yeah.
So asparagus being a perennial plant, eventually perennial weeds get in there. And I will tell you that when I started with Extension back in 1999, the first question that came into my office, somebody called in and said, yeah, how much salt should I put on my asparagus? Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, whatever you like the taste of, you know, because I never learned that in school. But just like we talked about earlier about the borax and boron becoming toxic to plants, salt is also toxic to plants, but asparagus has a higher tolerance than other plants. So the idea is you put salt on, it kills the weeds, but not the asparagus. But we also know that that really stresses the asparagus. So it's not really a recommended thing to do. Mulch can be good depending on the weeds, but if it's like quack grass, it's going to grow right through that. So you really kind of have to get in there and dig out as much of those weeds as you can. And then if you put on 4 inches of mulch, try that. And that should knock it back at least. And then you can do a little bit of that continuously to
clean it up. Yeah, clean it up. Dave, thank you for calling. Diana Alfeth will be with us for another half hour. It's great to have her with us. And you can join in at 604-212-1234 or email to talk@WPR.org. We'll be back right after this look at the news. Great to have you with us for Garden Talk on Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here talking with Diana Alfeth. She's a retired UW Extension horticulture specialist. She operated out of Pierce County. And great to have her back as we talk gardening. And I hope you'll join in with your questions. Maybe you're concerned about a tree or a shrub in your garden. Maybe you have questions about something that happened in your garden this year. Maybe you've got a humorous story to tell us about your garden this past year. You can email us to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Or, as good, give us a call. The number is 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email to talk@WPR.org. And let's turn to Sandy in northern Wisconsin. Hi, Sandy.
Hello. I have a situation where about 5-6 years ago, I put quite a bit of cranberry mulch from one of the cranberry farms up north on my small garden. And since then, absolutely nothing will grow. That first summer, I realized this was probably not a good idea. And I tried to get some of it out. In fact, there's a pile, small pile still sitting by the garden, and it has not even grown a weed in the last 5 years. I've tried to take most of it out, add some more topsoil. Any suggestions what else I can do? I put a few plants in last year just to see, and in a month they were smaller than when I put them in.
That's weird.
Have you done a soil test?
I have not. I'm not sure where to do that. I can send that to Madison or something, I believe.
Right. So my first thought is that cranberry mulch lowered your pH really far. And so cranberries typically grow in peat boggy types of areas. Cranberries and blueberries are related. They like low pH. I don't know about the mulch from the cranberry plants themselves, what their pH would be. But my suspicion is that it really is a low pH. And so then the fact that you put the plants in and they kind of go downhill tells me that those plants aren't able to take up nutrients. So there's nutrients in the soil. Plants can't take them up because the pH is maybe out of whack. So what you should do is if you just Google University of Wisconsin Soil Testing Lab, you will find the website for the soil lab that's down near Madison. And then there will be a place that will say, you know, sampling soils, and it'll be home and garden. And you just click. There's a form you print out there to fill out. There's the instructions. You can just use a, you know, Ziploc sandwich bag to take your soil sample, and you send it down to them. Just start with the basic test, which will tell you phosphorus, potassium, organic matter, and pH, and see what comes back. If your pH is really low, then you're going to have to add lime, or actually wood ash this case would raise it. If for some reason your pH was super high, you would add sulfur to lower it. And that might be your starting point. If your soil test comes back and the pH is normal, then I might send a sample back and ask for testing of some of the other nutrients and stuff in there. And you could even call the soil lab. They'll be happy to recommend which things you should test for, because each thing is like $5 for this nutrient, $10 for that sort of a thing. So they can narrow it down. But that's going to be my suspicion, is that your pH is out of whack. Now, if you put on so much mulch that it's basically all organic matter or all cranberry plants that you're trying to grow in, that could be a problem too. They might just need to decompose more so that you get more soil in there. because they might just not be, the root system might not be down into the soil where the nutrients are and being released. So that would be, you know, another question, but I would make sure that that's all kind of worked in with the soil and the cranberry stuff, and then start with a soil test.
Yeah, for sure. Sandy, thanks for calling. Susan in Duluth, Minnesota has, I think, a related question or comment. Hi, Susan.
Hello. Wonderful program. I have kind of a large garden, and I've taken soil samples once, of, you know, from different spots, and, but you're supposed to mix them all up and send them in. And I'm wondering what happens when you mix them all up. Don't you you don't get any identity about each part of your garden?
That's a great question. And the recommendation, what we usually recommended would be to, if you have reason to believe the soil in one spot is different from the soil in another spot, do separate tests. So for example, if you have a large garden and you've added compost to one end more than you have the other end, do two separate tests. Or if the soil's sandier on one end and clayier or darker in another end, do two separate tests. So the mixing them together thing works, like if your soil is looks and you, as far as you know, it's very uniform, then you're just kind of taking from a few different spots, mixing it together so that you have a good average and you can treat all of the soil the same. But if you have any reason to believe it's different, do two tests.
Yeah. Maybe there was a big sandbox on one end or something at one time.
Well, you know what? I had a client once who said, nothing will grow here, blah, 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 blah. And through a conversation, I found out that the previous owners had used that area as their burn pile. So they always burned all their brush there and stuff.
Oh.
And so even though it didn't look like there were ashes there, over all those years, the pH was like 8.5 or something. Ridiculous thing in that area. And it's like, you know, just move your garden to a different spot because that's going to take a lot to get out. So yeah, you don't, it's not always a visible thing.
Oh, man. Kevin in La Crescent, Minnesota, your turn. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, good morning, or good afternoon now, I guess. I built an asparagus garden a few years back, and it didn't go well. It's elevated on one side. I built it on a hill, so it's 4 feet deep on the downhill side. So then I replanted 2-year roots the year before last, and they came up quite well. So I was thinking this year it would be really great. So beginning of this year, I got some compost from a farmer, and there's quite a bit of clay and stuff in it. But I put it on probably 3 inches thick most of the place, maybe even 4 inches in some areas. The weeds did really good, but I only, after planting about 60 about 2-year roots, I only had about 20. Come up the second year. The first year they came up pretty well. So I don't know if I wrecked them or, like I said, the weeds did really well. But on a side note, I put the extra compost in a pile off in some other area of my yard, and not very many weeds grew in that compost, like none basically. So I don't know if there's something in that that's soaked down into the asparagus root, and I know I planted them quite deep, you know, probably 18 inches or whatever.
Yeah.
So I don't know.
So you said the compost had clay in it?
Yeah, there was some clay in it. Not, you know, there was some clumps that I threw out, but it wasn't like compacted clay or anything, no.
Okay. Yeah, because typically, again, compost should be just organic matter, you know. So maybe when they scooped the pile up or something, they dug into the soil below the pile, and that's where the clay was coming from. So, because that was my first thought, is if you're putting 3 inches of clay on top of your asparagus, which you planted very deep, maybe deeper than I would have, that might just be too much for those roots to come up and through.
But if nothing's growing on that other pile.
Yeah. Do you know what was this, like, composted cow manure, or what was the source of the compost?
Yeah, it's on an organic farm, and it was mostly cow manure.
Okay.
Well, that's strange.
It is. I don't necessarily have... So the thing is that compost actually normally doesn't grow weeds. So as far as putting the pile on the side and it didn't grow much for weeds, that's normal, because in a properly composted compost pile that's heated up, most of the weed seeds will have died. And so the compost itself shouldn't be a source of weed seeds. So the weeds that grew in the asparagus would have been your own weeds that were in that patch and stuff. I just, when you said you planted the asparagus 18 inches deep, that to me just sounds too deep, because those roots have to grow 18 inches until the plants get up and can start doing photosynthesis. And that might be part of the problem, even though, you know, the first year they came up fine and they were out there, usually then, you know, they send out more roots closer to the surface and stuff. But I don't really have a good answer for you.
Yeah.
That's a tough one without more investigation.
Yeah. Sorry, Kevin. I wish we had more help for you there.
And then the only other thing is, you said that it was kind of on a hillside and stuff. And even though, you know, you've worked with it and stuff, there's always the water question, because on hillsides, water runs down and it doesn't always soak in good. So maybe there was something to do with that, like the, you know, late fall the previous year, if they got dried out and then drought stressed, and that's why they didn't come back this year.
Yeah, that could be.
It's another thought. I don't know.
Another thought, Kevin. Thank you for calling. Anne in Madison, your turn. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I was wondering what you can tell me about getting rid of Bishop's weed. We've tried everything. The thing that works best is a mixture of salt and vinegar and burning it with fire.
Yeah, the problem is vinegar is burning off the top. It's not doing anything for your roots. Same with fire. So even though it looks like it kills it on the surface, it doesn't. And so then those roots are down there. They've still got energy stored in them, and they will creep and they will come back. So obviously there's the digging it out thing, but that can be pretty impossible. You can try to starve it out. And what I mean by that is a plant's energy, it's plant's food, comes through photosynthesis and the carbohydrates that are formed in the leaves, and that gets sent down to the roots and stored. And that's why when you take off the top, it keeps coming back. So if you're doing the vinegar or fire thing, that stresses them, because then they have to use some more energy from the roots to grow new leaves. But the problem is that, so vinegar is not the greatest option for doing that, because vinegar gets in the soil and now you're goofing up microbes in the soil too. My recommendation would be more that every time you see a little Bishop weed's leaf come to the surface, you somehow break it off at ground level. Now you can do that with a string trimmer and whack it really, really low. Again, the vinegar burns it off, but that vinegar is getting in the soil. That's, you know, vinegar's not necessarily an environmental product. You can do it by mowing them off, but you got to have your mower really, really short, because you don't want any green leaf tissue. If it's in a big enough patch, you can smother it. So you can put cardboard and mulch over it. People utilize like old carpet squares and stuff for that and try to smother it. And of course, there's the herbicides, but if you don't want to use herbicides, then you're pretty much left to trying to stress it over and over and over and over until it uses up all the energy that's in its root system and it can't come back. And I've dealt with a patch of this, and I've got it all the way down to one, like 2 square foot area that has come back, but I've whacked out most of the rest of it just by starving it out. But it's a tough one. And one little leaf or one little root system that survives will come back. So you really got to stay on top of it.
Yeah. How long did it take you to get that all out up to that little corner?
2.5 years probably of going through. I got this little patch of it that came in a planter from a relative, and it jumped out of that planter and into the flower bed somehow. And then by the time it's like, oh my gosh, look at all this stuff all over the place. And it is a very tenacious plant.
A listener emailed to ask if you need to mulch raspberry bushes and blackberries.
So raspberries, probably not. Raspberries are pretty hardy. Some people do, not so much for winter protection, but for weed control. So similar to what we were talking about with the caller previously on the asparagus patch, if you can keep weeds from getting into those patches, it's a whole lot easier than getting rid of the weeds once they're there. So putting down a few inches of mulch to keep weeds from getting in there every year, those canes are really powerful. They pop on through, and that's a good thing. But raspberries, not depending on the variety, most of them are plenty winter hardy. Blackberries are a little more questionable. There are some hardy varieties out there now, but up where I am here in West Central Wisconsin, we never used to have blackberries that were hardy. And now some of the newer varieties are, so people are able to grow blackberries. And mulching them a little bit now to give them a little extra winter protection in case we have a really cold and snowless winter, which we don't know yet, is not a bad idea. And again, using leaves, chopped leaves, straw, those kinds of things that will provide an insulating layer and catch snow those are good options.
Okay. Judy emailed from Florida to ask your opinion of countertop composters.
Oh, countertop. So like in the kitchen, in the little composter. So, you know, they might work for some people depending on how much volume of compostable stuff that you have. They use various, there are different sizes of them and stuff, and it might work for you. I have nothing against them. It's not like you're going to get a whole lot of usable compost out of them, again, just because of the volume sort of thing, but it might work for you if you don't have a place that you can just throw the stuff outside over winter. And it's a good way to keep kitchen scraps out of the landfills. And
go ahead. Well,
give them a try.
Here's another one relating in a way. Vicky in Lake Mills, she has a compost pile, done it for years, saves her kitchen scraps, always wonders what to do with them in the winter. Her plastic containers of veggie containers is in her garden. They freeze. She puts them in the containers. They freeze. And she finally adds them up to a pile in spring. She dumps them out. But can I add them in the winter because I don't have enough containers?
Yes, you can. You absolutely can. Yep, go right ahead. It's like I said, if it was once a plant, it's going to rot. And when it rots and decomposes, it will release the nutrients. So, and that's the thing too. You know, some people just throw their scraps not on a pile or in a bin or anything, but right onto the vegetable garden. And in spring, you've got, you know, visible, you know, where you can tell it was a banana peel or whatever and stuff. But unless you're doing a lot of it, you can just work that into the soil and it'll rot in the soil. So you can compost it in there. Some people will dig a trench in the fall and then dump it all in that trench over the winter. And then in spring, cover that up with soil. And then it composts right in that trench during the growing season. And you just don't plant in that area this year, but then the next year it'll all be rotted away and composted, and you can plant into that area. So there's a lot of different ways that you can compost.
Scott in Eau Claire actually has a comment on using compost.
Okay.
Scott?
Yes. I've been trying to grow asparagus for a lot of years, and the best way I found is this last, been not this last spring, but the spring before, I bought a truckload of compost from an organic farmer that had organic compost, and it was all treated so there was no weeds and stuff. So I built my raised bed 18 inches high, and I filled my raised bed 4x8 full of compost manure. Then I planted my plants in there like every 18 inches apart, a crown or whatever, about every 18 inches, as many as I could fit in the raised bed, let it grow. First year, they all came up really nice. And this last year, this season now, I was actually able to harvest some smaller shoots. I was reluctant to do it, but I said, well, you know, as fast as they're growing, as big as they're getting, I got to start cutting them so they start growing more roots or sprouting off. So I did that, and I stopped in July. And now I've got like hundreds of crowns or shoots coming out all over the place, and the whole bed is just covered with greenery all the way across the whole top, and they're about 3 feet high.
Oh, man.
Was remember, if you do the compost, make sure you mix lime in it right away when you do it to neutralize some of your acids.
Wow.
Well, don't automatically mix lime in there, because compost is not necessarily acidic. And that's a little bit of a myth. It's going to probably be on the acidic side, but not so low that things won't grow in it. And it does depend on what was put in there when it was composted. But I really don't like to give recommendations to automatically add something unless you do some kind of a test, because you could make it worse. But your success just shows that asparagus loves organic soil. It loves a lot of organic matter in the soil. And you obviously, it's like, you know, potting mix. You have all organic soil in there. And obviously a lot of nutrients were released. And so that asparagus is super, super happy. But compost can be used in a gazillion ways. It's not called gardener's gold for no reason. You can mix it into houseplants, containers. And again, because it is decomposed plants, it contains every nutrient plants need to grow, every trace nutrient, everything. And that's why a balanced compost is your best soil additive.
And there you go, Scott. Thank you so much for that question or that comment. Appreciate it very much. Jean emailed, her older rhubarb seems to need fertilizer. She heard it's a heavy feeder. Do you recommend fertilizing rhubarb? I never fertilize my rhubarb.
No, it's, I don't know that it's a heavy feeder. It's got a massive root system, so it's pretty good at mining nutrients out of the soil. However, it kind of does depend on your soil. So if the plant is not doing as well as it once was, then it needs something. In some cases, it needs dividing because it's just crowding itself out. If your soil is kind of hard and compacted, it could be, you know, where it's not as fertile as it once was. My first thought would be to get some of this wonderful compost we've been talking about. And if you just spread a couple inches of compost around the plants, maybe, you know, dig it into the surface of the soil a little bit, that sort of thing, that might be a good start for you, because it might just help loosen up the soil a bit and give it, again, any trace nutrient that it thinks it wants. If you want to sprinkle a little bit of all-purpose fertilizer on there, you know, like a garden fertilizer that's got like a 10-10-10 analysis, that's not going to hurt anything. So you could try that, see if that rejuvenates the plants And that'd be where I'd start.
And on that happy note, Diana, thank you so much. It's been a quick 90 minutes and a lot of fun. So you'll come back and be with us again?
Absolutely. I love helping out, and good to see you, Larry.
Good to see you. Diana Alfeth, recently retired as UW Extension Horticulture Outreach Specialist for Pierce County, and it's always fun to have her with us. Coming up, we'll take a look at picking and caring for your Christmas tree. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk. Little Brenda Lee rocking around the Christmas tree to get us going on this segment of our show. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today as we talk about picking and caring for your Christmas tree with our guest Laura Jalbach with us, Associate Professor and Extension Specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, expert on woody ornamentals, nursery management, and a whole lot more. And that, and of course, an expert on Christmas trees and their care. So we'll have you join in with questions about selecting and caring for your Christmas tree. You'll be able to do that. Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. And, you know, we thought it'd be fun before we even started talking with Laura to go to the movie A Christmas Story. Remember that story? It's Gene Shepherd wrote the book and the movie, and it plays for 24 hours on Christmas Day on one of the TV stations, and I've seen it many times. But there's a piece, just a short piece in there, where Ralphie, the boy who wants the Red Ryder BB gun, and his mother and his dad, who he calls the old man, go Christmas tree shopping. Let's listen to that little brief segment.
Here's a tree. This here is a tree. Oh, wait till the dog sees that one.
Don't you think it's a little large?
Christmas only comes once a year. Why not?
Why not?
Yeah, well, how much?
I'll knock off $2 because I can see you're a man who knows his trees.
This isn't one of those trees that all the needles falls off, is it?
No, that's some balsams.
This is a very nice tree.
Yeah.
I'll throw in some rope and tie it to your car for you.
You got a deal.
Oh, man, I've enjoyed seeing that movie many a time. And oftentimes on Christmas Day, you go by the set and you'll see in the middle and then you'll see the end and then maybe you'll see the beginning later on. Always fun. But the picking of the Christmas tree is what we're talking about here with Laura Jal. Laura, have you seen that movie?
Oh, many times, Larry. It's hilarious.
Oh, man. Well, here's the old man looking for a tree, and it's really funny. They kind of stomp the tree on the ground. The guy, the seller, does, and all the needles fall off of one. What do you look for when you buy a tree at a lot?
Well, the first thing I want to mention before I get into that is some people say, well, why even get a live Christmas tree? They only are going to be in your house for 2 weeks. Well, there's actually a lot of compelling reasons why we should have live Christmas trees instead of artificial trees. Many of these live trees are very environmentally friendly option compared to artificial trees that are made out of, various petroleum products or other products that aren't natural. And these trees live for, 7 to 10 years before they're actually harvested for Christmas trees. They're planted as young seedlings. And these trees can sequester a lot of greenhouse gases. They can also support us with the oxygen they produce every day. And many of these trees look and smell great in your home. and especially decorated with lights and ornaments.
Oh, I love the smell.
And there's certain ones that smell better than others. And in fact, one of the ways you can tell if you're collecting a quality tree is when you're at the either Christmas tree lot or tree farm or big box store, wherever you buy your tree, grab a hold of the branches, and especially one branch, and run your hands over it. If the needles fall off or are very dry and break off easily or are discolored, don't choose that tree. The needles should be firm and flexible have a nice, you know, green color or blue, if depending on the species you choose. And there are lots of different species you can choose from. In Wisconsin, the most common type trees that are grown are like your Fraser fir, your Concolor fir, your Balsam fir, your Canaan fir. There's also Douglas fir, Fats pine, Eastern white pine, Black Hill spruce, and even in Norway and Colorado blue spruce, which I personally wouldn't recommend Colorado blue spruce as a Christmas tree because the needles are incredibly sharp at the ends and can poke children and small pets. So that one I probably wouldn't use.
So, yeah, I like a spruce because it does where I buy my tree, which is actually about two blocks from my house. There's a farm family that comes every year, and they have their Christmas tree operation, and they sell a lot of Christmas trees out of the gas station that's right next door to it. And it's always a lot of fun, and they have some spruce that do pretty well. And they only cut their trees, they're not cut 3 months ago, you know, months ago.
Yeah. It's really, you know, to be honest, one of the best things that I like to do is actually go to a tree farm and cut your own tree. That way it is very fresh.
Yeah.
Inside. I mean, there's other species you can also use. Scots pine or Eastern white pine. It really depends on your taste, how big of a tree you want, and your budget. Obviously, fir trees are more expensive because they grow slower, but they really are the Cadillac of Christmas trees.
Yeah, and the costs have been going up on Christmas trees.
Well, and a lot of people are, you know, upset, and I agree. I mean, there are a lot of money, but that's a 7 to 10 year investment. So it's not something that can be like corn that you can plant and it grows in one season and you harvest it. It takes, you know, almost a decade to get these trees to be ready to be able to be cut and sold as Christmas trees. So it's a long-term investment for the grower.
Well, I always purchase mine. My daughter and I go to get our tree on Black Friday. So the day after Thanksgiving goes up that weekend, and it stays up until around the 1st of January. So it's up for at least 1/12 of the year.
I try to leave mine up as long as I can because I really enjoy it.
Yeah. Okay. So, I mean, if you're going to pick one yourself, what would you... I mean, some are better than others, aren't they? Talk about
that.
Oh,
absolutely. Well, you know, another thing I like to do is once I decide on a tree is I'll give it a good shake. Just, you know, lift the tree up and kind of stomp it down. And if a ton of needles falls off, don't get that one. You know,
that's like from the Christmas story clip.
Yeah, exactly. And you're going to lose some needles, but I have a handout that I sent to Jill. I think she's posting on your website of everything I'm talking about today and step-by-step instructions of how to keep your tree indoors. And one of the most important things is either at the place you're buying the tree from or at home, you need to give the tree base of the trunk, a fresh cut. You need to probably prune off some lower limbs so that the tree can fit into the tree stand that's holding it up that you're placing in your home. You want to give it a fresh cut about 1 to 2 inches off the end. And the reason why is it, depending on when the tree was harvested, especially if it was harvested a month or two ago and then shipped to the big box stores or garden centers, that cut end gets really dry and it won't suck up water very efficiently or at all because it's filled with sap. So by giving it a good fresh cut, you're allowing that tree water conducting tissues or xylem to uptake the water. Speaking of water, that is the only thing that is needed in that tree stand reservoir. The addition of bleach, sugar, molasses, syrup, honey, aspirin, soda, salt, fertilizer, or any of that commercial floral or tree preservative for Christmas trees doesn't improve needle retention, freshness, or water uptake and is entirely unnecessary. The most important thing you can do is add fresh tap water daily. And trees up to a 4-inch diameter at the base, most standard Christmas trees, they can imbibe a gallon of water per day. So you need to be checking that daily, especially the first week. They really suck up that water fast. And if the tree gets dry, then it forms these what we call embolisms in the xylem tissue, and they don't take up water very well after that. So it's really important to get a fresh cut and keep it well watered.
Yeah, and even with a fresh cut, you shouldn't be waiting around a couple days before you put it up.
No. No, in fact, if you can't put your tree up right away and you bought it, you can store it in an unheated garage as long as you give it a fresh cut and put it in a bucket of water until you're ready to move it into your house.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Laura Jull, our guest today, associate professor, extension specialist in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Great to have her with us today. We're talking about Christmas trees, picking them out, caring for them, maybe an experience to share with your tree. The number to call, 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Or you could send an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Taking a look at picking and caring for your Christmas tree on the show right now with our guest Laura Jull, UW Extension Specialist, Associate Professor, as a matter of fact, in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. Again, you can call at 800-642-1234, email to talk@WPR.org. Many years ago, I bought myself a really good stand, tree stand, a good sturdy one. What should you look for in a stand?
Well, you want something, obviously, that has a large reservoir because you need to be adding water. At least it should hold at least a gallon of water. The next thing is, some of these stands are so lightweight that once you put a tree in them, these Christmas trees, especially if they're very fresh, they can weigh a heck of a lot. And the flimsy stands can, not hold the tree very well and can, actually, the tree can fall over in your house. So metal is good. It doesn't have to be metal, but it has to be something that is wide at the base, especially if it's got like four, I don't know what you call it, prongs or whatever you call it, that lay on the floor. I'm trying to think of the word, Larry.
legs or something, you could say.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, ones that stick out that are flat against the floor because of the dynamics of the height of the tree, and you want some stability at the base. And one that can hold the tree trunk in place, so it has screws or clamps or something like that to anchor it, very secure.
Yes. Steve in Door County has something for us. Hi, Steve.
Hello. How are you?
Good. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I went to a tree farm last week, and I cut the tree myself. And the gentleman, as I was leaving, said, you don't have to put it in water right away. Wait until you get to a warm place to cut it. And he said that the sap actually forms on the base, on the trunk, when you cut it. and that seals the tree until you get into a warmer space and cut it. But I just heard her say that as soon as you get it into a cold space, you should cut it. So I'm kind of worried. It'll be another week before I get it to a warm place and into a Christmas tree stand. And I cut it a week ago, so that adds up to 2 weeks. What should I do?
If it's been 2 weeks, I definitely, you know, when you get home, if it's in your garage or shed or whatever, is give it a fresh cut and put it in water. Granted, if it gets below freezing, that water's going to freeze. Obviously, that's a problem. Yes, you can leave it outside of water, but, you know, the longer you leave it out of water, the longer it can dry out. And so when you bring it inside, you should have that cut already done because it makes a mess.
Yeah.
And then put it in the stand and add water. But, you know, if it's going to be a very long time, I don't know, I would personally put it in a bucket of water in a garage until you're ready. You don't have to do that, but just be aware that your tree's drying out. There's no roots there to uptake water.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Steve, there you go. Thank you for calling. Karen in Lindenhurst, Illinois, on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi, yeah, I bought a $100 tree 1 year and I put it in the garage in a bucket of water, as you suggested, like a week before I was going to bring it in. The whole thing soaked up the water immediately, and then the whole tree froze. Every branch on the thing was frozen.
So you had to thaw it out.
I had to go get another tree.
Oh!
No. Yeah, well, I suggest bringing it home and putting it up in the stand as soon as you can, but I realize sometimes you can't. But I have an unheated garage, but my garage is attached to my house, and it never gets below 30. So the Christmas tree I had was fine. But if you have an unattached garage or are in a very cold area, I agree, it might freeze, and it would be best just to buy it when you can and get it up right away.
Yeah. Oh, that's great stuff. Well, it's not a good story, but it was an interesting story to tell. And
yeah.
I bet you've told that one a few times, Karen. Thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate that very much. Well, Paul in Madison, you got a story for us.
Good afternoon, folks.
Hi.
Several years ago, great show, by the way. Several years ago, we went and cut our own balsam fir, brought it home, had to trim up the base a bit in order to fit it in the stand. But we got a self-waterer. It's just basically a 2-liter soda bottle that fits in a stand, and it's got a siphon hose that goes into the reservoir of the tree stand. Well, it was doing just fine, and we just made sure that every couple of days we checked the soda bottle to make sure it had water in it. Comes after Christmas, it's about New Year's, taking all the ornaments and lights off and everything else. There is new growth on this tree. And I called the guy that had the tree farm where we got it from. I said, have you ever heard of this thing? He said, no. So I just, I couldn't throw it out.
Oh, my goodness. Laura, what do you think?
Well, you bring a tree that's dormant from being outside into a warm house over the course of a couple weeks, you may get some buds that break. But this is not common, but I have seen it on Christmas trees, but they're not going to live very long because there's no tree roots there.
Yeah.
And it's basically a dead tree.
Yeah, but that's a pretty cool story anyway, Paul.
Yeah, it is.
Thanks a lot for calling. I'm wondering, you know, I have a location where I put my tree every year in the house. It's kind of right next, sort of next to the fireplace, and there's a window. Does location in the house affect how long a tree will kind of last before it starts dropping
off?
Yeah.
Yeah, I would definitely keep the Christmas tree away from any heat source, such as fireplaces, space heaters, wood-burning stoves, heat vents. These will dry out your tree a lot faster. Keep it out of direct sunlight, though, you know, most homes don't have very much light this time of year anyways. But definitely keep it away from any, you know, doors that constantly open and close. Those drying winds or dry air, excuse me, will dry the tree out fast.
Yeah. Some people have been getting, in fact, I got one year from, as a gift, a living Christmas tree, and then you plant them afterwards.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, is that, I can tell you what happened in my case. I did get it into the ground eventually, and the tree died right away, or close to.
Yeah. Well, it depends on the species. I've seen live Christmas trees, like, especially like Norfolk Island pines. That is not hardy here. That is a tree that grows on Norfolk Island, which is in the South Pacific. So it's definitely not cold hardy here. They're beautiful indoor house plants that look just like a Christmas tree. And I, you know, 1 year when I was in college, that was my Christmas tree.
Yeah.
And I just decorated it with lights and little ornaments, and it was really cute. Other times it can be evergreen species that is grown in the U.S., but it may not be hardy. Sometimes they're coming out from the state of Washington or Oregon, and they're these little tabletop trees, and they're very adorable, but they may not be truly cold hardy for us here. If they are a species that is cold hardy here, then and it's grown in a pot, and it's like a landscape tree that you would plant out in the yard later, it's too cold to plant them right now. The ground, at least here, is frozen. And not only that, the soils are pretty cold. You know, I do know people that have done that, and they put mulch down. The problem is those tree roots are not going to get established before we get into the below zero temperatures. So we've had some recently. And the foliage is just going to dry out because, you know, the root system is not established. You're going to need to water those plants. It's best, and I have done this, overwintered a potted tree or shrub in an unheated garage. Make sure it's well watered right when you put it in the garage. The pot will probably freeze in the roots. Make sure it's doesn't get below like 20, 25 degrees in the garage, and just make sure to check on watering during the winter if we get a January thaw or something like that. And then next spring, early spring, then pot it out in your yard, removing the pot and, of course, trying to get that root flare right at the soil line to prevent girdling roots.
And I should just mention that your handout that you mentioned earlier, the handout on Christmas trees that you have, is we have it in our program notes, the talk at WPR.org/Larry or WPR.org/Larry. Go to today's date and look in the program notes, and you will find that information there. What species do you suggest for planting in your yard for future decorating?
Well, it really depends on your soil type and where you are in the state. Obviously, you want it cold hardy enough. I mean, we've got people from northern Wisconsin, central and southern Wisconsin, as well as Michigan and other surrounding states. And so, again, it depends on your cold hardiness zone. Second of all, your soil type. Firs are absolutely gorgeous trees, whether you get a balsam, Fraser, Hainan, or concolor fir, or even a Korean fir. I have several in my yard, but my soil is conducive to growing them. Fir trees need absolutely good drainage. They will not tolerate heavy clay or poorly drained soils. They also like a slightly acidic pH, soil pH around 6.5, 6. Mine is like 7.2. It's doing just fine, but you need that awesome drainage of the soil. It will not tolerate wet soil. Same with eastern white pine, which is another native tree, that and red pine. Both of those pine species need very good drainage. When it comes to spruce, they're a little bit more tolerant. I personally would avoid planting any Colorado blue spruce, and the reason why is diseases. They are exceptionally disease susceptible and short-lived trees. In fact, it's one of the most common samples Brian Huddleston gets in the plant disease diagnostic lab to identify what killed it. Our other spruces are susceptible to diseases, too. I think one of the better spruces, I mean, I'm not saying it's completely disease resistant, but Norway spruce is one.
On that note, Laura, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it so much. Laura Jell from the UW Extension Specialist and Associate Professor in CALS. Great to have her with us and great to have you listening in. And I hope you'll please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News. I'm Larry Mueller.